Welcome to That 80s Show, and if you've never listened to That 80s Show before, Dory and I are massive fans of Wham. When a Wham documentary pops up on Netflix, we're like, we have to get somebody. We got to find somebody, get the contact, everyone phone a contact. And of course, the chart savant Barrett Edelstein comes through for us and says, listen, I have one of the producers of the Wham documentary, and he's happy to talk to you guys. Now, that's great. And then we start looking into the gentleman in question, a man named Simon Halfon. Now, you may not know that name, but he is a graphic designer who has done album covers for bands like the Style Council, The Jam, Kim Wilde, Oasis, and George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley on solo albums. And he told us about how he got into something, because it's quite interesting to find out somebody who's like in such a unique part of the record industry, how he became friends with George and Andrew, and how the Wham documentary came about. It's a really fun conversation. We could have spoken to Simon for about 2 hours, but we did our best to capture everything in 30 minutes. We hope you enjoy listening to this as much as we did putting it together. And listen, if you've not watched the Wham documentary on Netflix yet, what is wrong with you? Get yourself a subscription. Go to a friend's house. Password cheat if you can still do such a thing. You have got to watch the Wham documentary. It is probably one of the best pieces of band memorabilia, one of the best band documentaries we have seen in history. And we're not biased. That is like a, you know, that is an unbiased opinion. Enjoy this conversation. That 80s Show meets Simon Halfon. As much as we were excited to go Wham documentary, find someone to just talk to, then you come about and we're like, well, hold on a second here, because this is more than about a Wham documentary. We're talking about somebody who's got an impact on music or on the music industry further than that. So if you don't mind me asking you just about yourself and your kind of background, and I think what's so interesting is that you're very modestly described as a graphic designer, but it's like, oh, hold on a second. You've worked with the Luminaries of the Jam, you've worked with Style Council, you've worked with Oasis and George Michael as an album art designer, right? How did you get into designing album covers?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I'll take you back to the very beginning on that one. I didn't have any training or formal training. And I was, as a young boy who kind of left university prematurely, shall we say, I wanted to work in the music business. And this is the summer of kind of autumn of 1980. So that already ages me, I know. But I was young and I bumped into, I was walking down Oxford Street in London, and I saw this guy called Cosmo Vinyl. And Cosmo Vinyl kind of famously in my world was kind of like the Clash, the band, the Clash is kind of right-hand man. Yeah. He wasn't their manager, but he was their kind of, he was always with them and he was their aide-de-camp or however you want to describe him. But he was this kind of larger than life character. And I just saw him walking down the street and I went over and sort of just pestered him and said, oh, hi, how are you? And chatted to him for about 5 minutes. And within that 5 minutes, he just happened to mention that he was working at Stiff Records. And so when I left university, as I said, prematurely, I wanted to work in the music business. And I thought, well, I'm set up. I know someone. I know Cosmo Vinyl. So I went, put myself down to Stiff Records, and I was a big fan of Stiff Records. Stiff Records was one of the first independent, and probably one of the most famous independent record labels. It came out of punk and new wave. You know, the artists on their label when they signed were bands like The Damned and Elvis Costello and Ian Dury and The Blockheads. So, yeah. And I used to go in there on my way back from school and you get free badges and free posters. And so that was a sort of a kind of a touchstone for me. Anyway, so I pop into Stiff Records and say, the lady at reception said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'll come see Cosmo Vinyl. He said, well, he doesn't come in every day. And when he does, you know, he doesn't come in until the afternoon. So I said, do you mind if I wait? So wait, I did. And 45 minutes later, Cosmo bowls in and he sort of kind of looks at me, kind of half knowing, half recognizing me, and sort of points at me. And I said, well, I've come to see you. And he said, well, how can I help you? And he said, I said, can I have a word? And he said, come on then. And he takes me into the post room there. And he said, how can I help you? And I said, well, I'd like to come and work for you. And he said, well, listen, the Trash aren't doing anything at the minute, and I'm not sort of getting paid. But he said, hang on a minute. And he goes out of the post and comes back in 5 minutes later. And he says, do you want to work here? And I said, yeah, great, love to. So I started working at Stiff Records in the post room that, from that point on. And sort of did that for, a few months and kind of loved it. It was a really great kind of vibe there. Madness were the kind of big act at the time. And it was just a really good, fun place to work. And then they moved me into being a plugger, which I didn't really enjoy. But it gave me the chance to go down to Top of the Pops and see all these bands and kind of hang out and meet a few people and this, that, and the other. And one of those bands that I met was a guy called Vaughan Toulouse, who had just signed to his band, Department S, had just signed to Stiff Records. And he had said to me, we'd become friendly, and he said to me, oh, I want to design my next record sleeve. And I said, oh, I'll help you. So we came in one Sunday and we did the sleeve for his next single, which is nothing to write home about. And so from that point on, because I was such a terrible plugger, they moved me into the art department. So that's how I kind of got into designing record sleeves, although I wasn't really designing. And in those days, it was a kind of physical skill. It wasn't like today where, there's an app on your phone to design an album cover. Back then, you had to physically be able to mark up boards. It was a trade, I guess. So I didn't know any of that. And I'd run its course a little bit. Then with Stiff, they kind of thought, hold on a minute, put this guy in the art department, but he can't really do anything. And as luck would have it, a former employee in the art department at that time was a guy called Neville Brody. And Neville Brody had just left Stiff and had gone on to work on his own. And part of where he was working was at the Face magazine. The Face magazine had just started, which is a hugely influential magazine. And he was a designer. And he said to me, do you want to come and be my assistant? And that's kind of where I learned the ropes, and he taught me everything that I kind of knew, which wasn't much, but it kind of got me started. And it was at that point in time where I kind of become friendly with two people. One was Kim Wilde. And Kim Wilde said to me, oh, would you like to do my next single? So she gave me my first break, really. And I said, and she was, she just had a huge hit with Kids in America. And this is her kind of second record, or first track off her second record. And so I did that. So that kind of got me started a little bit. But that's when I first had become friendly with Paul Weller. And I remember getting a call from Paul, because he'd asked me if I wanted to design a kind of book of poetry for him, which I said, yeah, I'd love to. Because he was very good at supporting young people. That was his thing. And this is right at the tail end of the Jam. And then one day he called me shortly after that. I said, listen, do you want to come down to the studio? Something I want to talk to you about. And they had a studio up in Marble Arch in London. And he said, listen, I'm splitting the Jam up. I'm starting this new band. You want to do the covers for our new group? My new group is called the Style Council. And I thought, oh, my God, yeah, absolutely. So I kind of jumped at that. And then from that kind of point on, sort of became freelance, but sort of was learning as I went, really. So that's an extremely long answer to what was a very short question.
No, and I mean, how do you, it's always weird. You ask people, tell me where you started. It's like, oh, well, okay. Do you want the beginning or the end? I think so many things you said there. So I in my previous life was in advertising, and back in the days that I was a copywriter, and they'd put you with a graphic designer or an art director. And it was the early days of like Photoshop, right? So we're talking like about 20 years ago. But when we went in with the more senior guys, they were all very, like you said, it was a craft. And you go into the studio and you got, Barrett, it was typesets, right? That's what they're called. They're like little block of letters.
Yeah.
And
drawing boards. And
spray mount boards. Like, God help you if you like stepped in something, you're walking out with like half a pitch deck on your shoes.
Yeah. Or breathe it in.
Exactly. You're kind of like, are we brainstorming before or after the visit to the, around the spray mount? Strikes me is that, and you kind of think about how controlled and industrialized the record industry is now. But for you to just like have the artists and the band say, oh no, they had that much control over what their albums look like. I mean, it seems so natural, but I think we're like in such a space of like where everything is so tightly controlled. But back then it was like, no, this is how I want it. And you're the guy who can help bring that about, right?
100%. That's it's changed dramatically since then. Everything's done by committee now. But back then, you know, Paul Weller kind of pointed at me, so even Kim Wilde said, listen, this is the guy that's doing my thing. It's like, okay, he's doing it. And whatever we, certainly in the Style Council, we didn't show anything to anyone within, you know, for their approval. This, we delivered the artwork. As long as Paul and Mick kind of signed off on it, they were happy with it, then off it went. And in those days, it was, you had to use a bit of imagination as well, because it wasn't like you had anything to show, like a printout of what it would look like. Literally artwork with overlays, with kind of a tracing guide where the picture would be, and, you know, a little Pantone guide for the actual color that you'd think. So a lot of it was kind of like a roll of the dice. So you got a proof back from the printers. You didn't know what the thing was going to look like. Even as a designer, you were kind of sweating a little bit, thinking, oh my God, I hope that you'll be able to read that, or that will work, or whatever it is. But it was very much, if the artist wanted it, then the recording artist, then that's what they got. I mean, famously, in my little world anyway, when the Style Council did their third album, it was called The Cost of Loving, and Paul and I were massive Beatles fans. And so instead of doing the white album, we did the orange album. So the sleeve was completely orange with a sort of self-embossed title that said The Cost of Loving, and the Style Council, I don't think it even said the Style Council, it might just said TSC, again embossed in orange, very much in the same way the white album. And you know, no one could understand why we did that. They just kind of thought it was kind of like career aside for the band to do that, but we did it because we thought it was fun and we enjoyed it and we liked it. But it got a lot of flack, that, and I think it was probably little moments like that where the reins were slightly pulled in by the record company, thinking, well, hold on a minute, we're giving them a bit too much leeway here.
How much did the album influence what you did, though? Because, I mean, would you be involved in the process of making the album, or be with the band at least while they were making, so you knew what you're doing? Or was it just an idea?
Certainly in the case of the Style Council, you were very, it was like a little gang. And so, as I said, they had these studios in Marble Arches, just right in the heart of the West End of London. And you would just pop in, you know, if you were in the neighborhood, you'd pop in for a cup of tea. We would meet pretty much every morning for coffee, cappuccinos, as it was back then. And we would just sort of chew the fat, and we were sort of discovering things, because it was all about, the influences were very sort of European and American Ivy League and Blue Note record sleeves and jazz. So it wasn't like today where you can just Google something or go into Waterstones and look in a book. You know, you kind of had to flick through record stores to look through the racks and see things that you liked. And those became your real life influences. And so it was a journey of discovery for us all, you know, for Paul and myself. So we very much collaborated on things, and he was very keen on, he'd almost kind of have an idea for an album cover, even in his solo years. Before he started recording, he said, I've got an idea for the new record sleeve, for the new album cover or the new single or whatever it is. And he hadn't even recorded it yet. So it was very, that kind of thing was very, very important to him. And because of that, we were kind of given free range, really, because it meant so much to him. And the record company knew that. So they kind of let him have a free hand.
Yeah. I mean, it's phenomenal. It's such a crucial role, because so many albums, when you think of it, you're not even thinking of this, the album just comes to your mind. You think of a song and it's just, you see the album. Yeah. So you know, to kind of get those aligned is so crucial. And it's such a lost art, I think, we have nowadays, because our music isn't physical anymore. Barrett is huge on it. He still buys physical discs and physical CDs. And so much of it is lost in kind of, you lose that moment of where, you know, you remember you're going through and you're opening that cover and you're looking and you're seeing Simon's name down there, designed by, and you're seeing the lyrics. And we've kind of lost that in our kind of music's, it lost that tactile feel, you know, to not over,
yeah, no,
to not over very good. Yeah.
I absolutely agree. So I've kind of, through Instagram, got in touch with another, it was a big influence on me. And then you had kind of how to get hold of us. So that was kind of one of the pluses of Instagram, I think, is that we kind of connected on Instagram and we've sort of having a few conversations about things. But he's a guy called John Kosh. And John Kosh, I guess, very famously designed the Abbey Road and Let It Be album covers, and then went on to design, you know, album covers for Mark Bolan and Rod Stewart, James Taylor, and Ronstadt, and Hotel California for the Eagles. I mean, this is a kind of a serious kind of player in the game. But, you know, we had a conversation that it kind of, that moment of taking something out of a bag or whatever and studying it, and it was kind of the 12-inch square format, was something that we all kind of grew up with, really. And it's, you know, I was very lucky to sort of have a career that kind of overlapped the sort of, not quite the golden era of it, but certainly the tail end of the golden era of that, if you like, where records still mattered. You know, there was only two formats when I was doing things. It was, when I first started, it was the cassette and the vinyl. Those were the two formats, you know, and then came the CD, and then came the sort of the thumbnail thing for iTunes, which was sort of the most depressing thing, really. Because I remember, God rest his soul, sitting at this very desk with George Michael, and one of his last releases was just an iTunes release. It wasn't a physical release. So George was very hands-on with record sleeves, and very meticulous, and would sit for hours pouring them this in, let's try this, try that color, try this, try that. And so we just sort of had to do like an iTunes banner for this new single. And we sort of did it, and we just sort of looked at each other and went, oh, is that it? Yeah. You know, that's it, kind of thing. So it kind of didn't have the magic anymore. And it's coming back now because vinyl's had a bit of a resurgence, but it's never kind of what it was. Even in the early 2000s, I remember when I did the cover for Oasis, and it wasn't even their biggest album by any means. The first album I did for Oasis was Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, which is the one with kind of the New York skyline. Yeah. And the first week, records, I mean, they did 600,000 units over the counter, and that's just in the UK. And today, if an album, a hit album, lifespan, it sells 600,000, you know, that's a hit. But to do that, you know, first week is quite something. So, yeah, the times have changed a little bit, you know, and so too many choices, too many. Not saying that's bad either, but it's just times have changed.
Things are very fleeting, and I want to, you know, I feel like so remiss to jump such a big portion, but I don't want to take up tons of your time, and kind of want to talk about the documentary, the Wham documentary. So obviously you worked with George Michael. It was the first time you worked with him on the Listen Without Prejudice album, or had
that's
you
correct.
You done some work before?
No, that's correct. No, we worked. That was the first thing we worked on together. We'd been friends for a while before that. We got to know each other kind of during the Wham period, just through mutual friends. And then he lived up the road from me, and then we sort of had quite a close little knit circle of friends. So we would just kind of go out for dinner. I remember once coming back from dinner, he dropped me home, and just as I was getting out of the car, I said, listen, this is after Faith. I said, listen, I'd love to have a crack at doing Listen Without Prejudice. Because I knew he was a fan of what I'd done, because he, you know, he really liked the Style Council sleeves and this, that, and the other. And he said, yeah, great, let's do it. You know, so that's kind of where we started our kind of working relationship. But we've been friends for a long time before that. And then, you know, sort of jumping forward, just after Listen Without Prejudice came out, we both ended up living in Los Angeles pretty much at the same time by coincidence. And neither of us really knew anyone else. So we kind of would have lunch and dinner together most days and kind of just hang out for, you know, those early 90s. It was during the whole of the early 90s, actually.
In essence, then, the Wham documentary was like many years in the making, right? What was the final push to get it made and to go into production and to tell the story?
It came about because I'd known Andrew a long time as well. And in fact, I worked with Andrew before I worked with George, because I designed Andrew's solo album, Son of Albert, which is still one of my favorite all-time album titles.
Yeah.
So I've worked with him, but I've known Andrew a long time. We've always got on well. And I had produced the Oasis film Supersonic, which was kind of a celebration of the phenomenon that was Oasis, from the 2.5 years it took for them to sign off on the Dole to having 2.3 million ticket applications for when they played at Nebworth. So it was a the story of a phenomenon. Andrew and I had lunch a few months before his autobiography came out. And he said, oh, I'd like to do something, maybe a little television documentary to promote my book. Would you be up for producing it? And I said, absolutely. And after lunch, I kind of called him up and I said, Andrew, this is a huge story. This is, you know, it's not a, you know, like a half hour thing or an hour thing on TV. This is a kind of feature length documentary because it's very much like the Oasis story. It's a phenomenon. Mm. You know, 1982, you leave school. 1986, you play your last gig at Wembley Stadium, conquering the world in between. So I said, let's give it time. You know, we won't be able to get that done in time for your book, but let's really get the ball rolling and make this into something that's really celebrates those fabulous times. And so that's when we kind of got the ball rolling. We met with George's, you know, the people that look after George's estate, and kind of got the ball rolling. Well, the first call I made actually was, as I had done on Supersonic, I wanted to work with kind of like a heavyweight producer. So on Supersonic, I worked with James Gabriese, who produced Senna and was in the middle of producing Amy. And on this one, you know, I was a big fan of John Batsek, and so I cold called him. I said, listen, you don't know me, but what do you think about Wham? And he said, can you come in tomorrow? So I went and had a meeting with him. He was on board right away. And the next call I made was to Netflix saying, what do you think about this? And they said, come in tomorrow. So I went in tomorrow. So literally had those two guys on board immediately. And then Netflix suggested the director, Chris Smith, who, you know, has got a fantastic body of work, whether it's the Fire, Party on Fire story, or the Jim Carrey and Andy Kaufman thing, you know, Jim and Andy. I love those films. And he was on, he said yes immediately. And to both, all of these, to John, to Chris Smith, and to Kate at Netflix, I said, listen, this is a celebration.
Yeah.
There's no kind of dark underside to it. It really is what it says on the tin. And they said, absolutely, that's what we want. Because there is no dark side to Wham. You know, it's such a, you know, see, because I said the film's got to be like when you hear a Wham record on the radio, just kind of puts 100%. A smile on your face. That was the goal. And I wanted to do, you know, George is a dear friend, and I wanted to do something that celebrated both him and Andrew and this part of George's career, which I'm not saying it's been forgotten about, but sometimes it's been overshadowed by George's monumental success thereafter. I think people forget what an incredible launch pad Wham was and what an incredible body of work. You know, it was hit after hit after hit after hit. It's an incredible story.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the celebration aspect came through so strong. So, I mean, like, you know, we got a show and the Wham thing is you know, our admiration for Wham is played for gags, right? But not for gags, it's very lighthearted, but people who aren't as ingrained and hadn't read Andrew's book and went, wow, there's actually no dark side to it. And like you said, it's a celebration because we're a generation that was raised on MTV Behind the Music or VH1 Behind the Music. So you're always waiting for that, oh, stratospheric success, but then a dark secret was going to rip them apart. Or, but then George's soul. And that never came. And it was so appreciated.
And then they fell out. Or then they hated each other. And
exactly. And it wasn't there. And it was exactly that. And I said to a colleague of mine, I said, watching so much of that reminded me of Uring Wham for the first time. Like, I think the Careless Whisper footage, when you kind of show that extended cut of the video, you go, wow, that was so powerful. And you go, I've heard the song, I've seen the video a million times, but to see it in that way and framed in that way and just this arc of it was like, that is, it's just a phenomenal celebration of two amazing artists. And I think Andrew came out of it with people going, wow, that is huge respect for the decisions he made.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think that the goal was to create something. And that's why it was so important for me for this film to be archive driven, no talking heads. Mm. And it was only as we kind of got into it and kind of found all this fantastic post-Wham George interviews where he talks so meticulously in such great detail about Wham that we thought, let's just keep it to a two-hander. Because originally maybe we think, oh, we should get Sherman and Pepsi and get D, but then all of a sudden it just felt so intimate being their two voices, because ultimately, you know, Wham were George and Andrew. But we also wanted the story to play out as you're watching the film. So it almost feels like you're following their journey with them at the time, and for it to sort of feel conversational between the two boys as they begin this fantastic journey. And yeah, it really worked. We had a fantastic editor,
yeah,
and pieced it all together so perfectly. And we, you know, we came across great audio archive, which hasn't been heard before, and so much great footage that had never been seen. And if it had been seen, hasn't been seen for 40 years, you know. So we were really lucky, but it took time to get it right. You know, these things always do. Nothing kind of happens. We got our team together very quickly, but it's finding these bits of footage. It's like finding, it's like looking for several needles in several haystacks. You know, you know it exists, but no one knows quite where it is. And then all of a sudden you kind of chance upon it, or someone remembers they've got it under their bed or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were very lucky. But no, thank you for that, because it was really important for it to feel like it was, you know, telling their story with honesty. And that was the thing, you know, when you hear George talk, if George was anything, he was brutally honest, but he was also kind of self-deprecating. He had a great sense of humor, and he's got a fantastic warmth and charm, which Andrew also has. And so to get, you know, being able to sort of marry those two together, just using those two voices, really made it feel like a heartwarming story. It's a story that you kind of, you watch the film with a smile on your face, and you get slightly misty-eyed in places as well. Cause,
100%, yeah. I mean, that audio device, I mean, what you're talking, and it was just so perfectly lined up. And sometimes when you're in the industry, you're trying to see where the strings are. You go, oh, surely it was pre-recorded or whatever. And you go, no, it's so authentic that it was definitely, you know, said, and it was all naturally done. And so that was the one device we really liked. But the second device, and how much input did you have on the whole scrapbooking elements of it?
Well, the scrapbooks, you know, when Andrew first said, I've got my mum's scrapbooks, I thought, oh, he's got 3 scrapbooks or something. I didn't realize it'd be 50 of them, which is fantastic. And it was Chris Smith, the director, who said, let's make this our kind of, not device, but I guess in many ways a device for telling the story, because we can use it for sort of bridging scenes, if you like. And it was a genius idea, because it, you know, it would be one thing if these were just scrapbooks that had been done by a clippings agency or a PR firm, but this is Andrew's mum that did them. So it kind of made it feel even more personal. You've got the two boys talking, and here's the mum's kind of scrapbook. And then we had this fantastic guy, Stefan, who is Chris Smith's VFX guy, who kind of brought them to life, animated the scrapbooks in such a great way that it really makes the film feel special, and it allows it to kind of roll along as well. That's the beauty of the film. It kind of, it's 90 minutes to just kind of whizzes by.
It
rolls along perfectly.
Yeah, we've been telling so many people on the show and in our personal life to say, to love the documentary, we say, get in line, we're going to loan you the book, because Andrew's book, because the scrapbooks are referenced in there, and so much of it is referenced in there, and it's so amazing to see it come to life, and almost like even better than you imagined it. I just kind of want to close off with saying that the responsibility that a lot of you who were in George's life had of keeping his memory so positive and so alive, it's something that really strikes in anything you hear Andrew ever say, and Pepsi and Shirley and yourself, or what you've said, because I think it's very similar to Freddie Mercury and Queen, how they've kind of kept his legacy, and this responsibility that all of you taken on to tell this amazing story of what was a phenomenal man who would have, I mean, legendary, but would have, you know, I think a lot of the sadness is going, what could George have still been achieving today? But those of you as custodians of his memory, I think for fans, we look at it, we go, it's so appreciated, because you tell the story, and even though we've never met him, don't know, we feel like we know him through every story all of you have told. So I think it's so appreciated by Wham fans. And I just wanted to have the opportunity to thank you more than anything on that.
That really means a lot. And I really appreciate that. And it's funny, in the September before George passed, and the two of us spent a lovely evening together, and he absolutely loved Supersonic. And, you know, to the point of, saying it's spectacular, spectacular, you know, and giving a big hug afterwards. And I think it kind of struck a chord with him as well, because he got quite emotional watching, because it seeing an artist connect with an audience on such a grand scale, I think really resonated with him. Mm. Anyway, so when the idea came up to do this documentary, I had no doubt in my mind that he would love to do a similarly styled kind of archive-based film. But all the way through the making of it, I'm thinking, oh, he'll like this. Oh, he'll like this. You know, oh, yeah, he'll like this. So, you know, I that was front and center all the way through. And so when Shirley came to see it for the first time before we quite finished it, well, first Andrew saw it and loved it, and then Shirley saw it, and then we showed it to George's sister, which always was always going to be a tough watch for her. And she loved it too. I just felt, you know, that we kind of done those for me with all the boxes that needed ticking. Because if those guys signed off on it, then I knew we'd done a good job.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal job. And Simon, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And I would love to talk more and unpack more, but I know you're a busy man. So we really do appreciate your time.
Where I am now, so we can pick this up again whenever you want.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Simon. We do really appreciate that. And like I say, once again, such great fans of your work, of what we first contacted you for, but I think the discovery of what you've done and your work before has just been really inspiring, just really great to look at. So thank you so much.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. I really appreciate that.